We're looking at how we work with karma niyama processes and how we work with dharma niyama processes by using these five aspects of spiritual life. And I hope what you're doing as we're going through each of them is looking at your own life to see where you are working on these, and also, more importantly, where you are not, and how you can work more effectively with them. So we've looked at integration, the gaining of moral agency, and the enlargement of your sense of moral agency so that it includes all aspects of your life, where that's possible. We've looked at developing positive emotion, that is, developing skillful karma, so that you're shaping karma more fully. And because of that work of integration and positive emotion, your karma is producing a new you, a more refined, more whole, more positive, more creative you. More loose, less fixed, less bony, you might say, less hard. And you're developing spiritual receptivity, that is, dhammic responsiveness, developing in yourself a capacity to respond to value. Value in the most near sense and value in the highest sense. Starting with what is near and reaching up to what is highest. And looking for those first stirrings of Dhamma Niyama processes emerging as Karma Niyama enables you to experience them more directly, more clearly. We looked at spiritual death, which is getting out of the way, breaking through that false structure of self-identification that blocks the flow of creative energy, blocks the flow of Dharma Niyama processes. So when you do this, all this, more and more fully there emerges something extra, something that already you're sensing before you arrive at the stage of spiritual death, but that with spiritual death emerges fully within you and becomes you, you could say, with still edges of self-clinging around it, blocking that flow, or rather just giving some drag to that flow, although the flow cannot be reversed. What emerges is the Dhamma Niyama processes in their fullness after the phase of Yatha Bhuta Jnana Darshana, in the spiral path. You have those Dhamma Niyama processes emerging much more fully and explicitly. You get Yatha Bhuta Jnana Darshana, seeing things as they really are. Then what comes? Nibbida, disgust. So completely uninterested in the productions of self and their counterparts. And then viraga, which is the sense of complete detachment and freedom. Then vimoksha, which is that freedom at its fullest. And then asava kaya jnana, the recognition that you've finally destroyed all that takes you back into the round, into the wheel. So yes, the spiral process, spiral path processes become irreversible. So that's what happens when you really die spiritually. So there's a continuous stream of selfless mental states. Those states are unbeclouded by self, so that they see things as they are. Seeing things as they are is quite natural, quite spontaneous, when you destroy self-clinging. It's self-clinging that leads to delusion. Self-clinging is delusion, and it leads to delusion. It's as if we've got a veil in front of our eyes, so we can't see clearly. When you remove the veil of self, things emerge naturally as they are. That stream of selfless states is not pegged back to self. Before we enter the stream, everything cycles back to I. You can have a strong impulse of metta, but that metta eventually comes back to I. You can have a strong mood of inspiration, but that mood of inspiration cycles back to I. I appropriates all your impulses beyond I. So when your mental states are no longer pegged to, don't cycle back to I, you naturally reach out to others. You naturally empathize with them. You naturally feel sympathy with them. You naturally shake with them, vibrate with them. Anukampana, this vibrating with, which is another way of talking of compassion. So that your heart resonates with theirs, spontaneously, naturally, because self doesn't get in the way. Your energies are not checked or blocked by self-clinging. Self-clinging pegs our energies, holds them in, so that we're not able to be fully creative. We're no longer confined by our conceptual constructions, which are based upon an abstraction from experience, which simplify so that we can manipulate, but falsify in that simplification. So you could say we're no longer bound by the strictures of space and time. This is where it gets a bit weird. We enter the realm of the magical, the realm of the mysterious, where our ordinary ways of thinking and understanding no longer quite work. Things happen that don't fit into the ordered structure of space and time. In my paper on a suprapersonal force, you may remember if you've read it, I refer to Bhante's experience as he went to Nagpur in 1956 for that moment when, in the fullest sense, it seems as if Dhamma-Niyama processes emerged within him. You remember he was in Bombay and his friend Dr. Mehta was urging him to stay with him because he was undergoing a sort of meditative retreat, and Bhante knew that would be very beneficial for him, but he says he knew he had to go. He knew he had to go to Nagpur. In terms of, you know, ordinary logic, he could easily have put it off. He could have gone a day or two later, a week later. There was nothing pressing that meant he had to be in Nagpur, had to be in Calcutta, which was where he's ultimately destined to go. He had to be there sometime that month, but not then. But he felt he had to go. He didn't know why. And of course, when he arrived in Nagpur, it was to find that Dr. Ambedkar had died and that, as it were, he had a job to do, to rally people. And he never makes it quite explicit, but clearly he feels that something was going on which wasn't to do with ordinary logic. Some sort of force was at work which defied ordinary space and time. You might think this is all a bit far-fetched, but when you enter this realm, when you leave behind at all decisively ego clinging, things work in very different ways, and connections are made that go beyond space and time. They go beyond space. So you feel more connected with things around you, not through immediate sensory connection, but even beyond time. So things in the past can call you, things in the future can call you, even things in the past can call you. There's that very striking moment in Bhante's memoirs, the Rainbow Road. He goes up to Pathankot, I think, in the Himalayas, and just before he goes forth, before he burns his passport and becomes a wanderer, takes on the Anagarika life, he is taken to visit a hermitage where a great yogi had lived in the past. And what he says is he felt an immediate psychic connection with that figure in the past. You know, don't take all this too literally, but at the same time, don't take it too symbolically. Take it literally symbolically, or symbolically literally, if you see what I mean. Take it imaginatively and really. But he says that he felt an immediate psychic connection with this figure who'd lived several generations ago, and that this, as if this was confirming his decision to go forth. I asked him about this more recently. I said, what did you mean by that psychic connection? He looked a bit puzzled and said, well, I felt a psychic connection. So enough said. But what I take that to mean is that when you get, at least even temporarily, momentarily, occasionally, what to speak of when you get there permanently, you find connections made that are outside the stream of space and time. I remember an order member who was travelling with Bante in Italy telling me a few remarkable things. But he told me one thing in particular. He went with Bante to Venice. They were doing the Renaissance, as it were. And it's always very, very interesting. I've done this a little bit myself, travel to cultural sites in the West with Bante. But on this occasion, he went to Venice. And they went into a particular church. And I still haven't been able to identify which one it was. But apparently he turned to this order member and said, something happened here, something very, very important for the, I can't remember the word he used, whether it was psychic or spiritual, I'll have to check on that, for the psychic or spiritual life of the West. Something very important happened here. So when you are more alive to these Dhamma Niyama processes, they defy space and time. Sorry, chaps, back to the 60s and all that, I know. Peace and love and acid and all that. But, well, this is, reality is not ordered in the linear, two-dimensional, even three-dimensional fashion that we think. When you begin to touch on these sort of dimensions, reality begins to connect in ways that are quite different and mysterious. And even one may have had some experience of that oneself. Well, I may have, and you may have. And, well, I seem to feel I have. I can't prove it to you, but there are times, particularly with Bante, when I felt, well, when he and I have had simultaneously the same ideas, the same inspirations, whether they came from him or whether they were discovered together, perhaps it no longer matters. But, yes, when you enter the stream of the Dhamma, normal modes of consciousness operate at the margins, and you find yourself increasingly in another dimension. You remember him talking about his contact with Chetol Sangye Dorje in particular, and also Kachu Rinpoche. I mentioned something with Kachu Rinpoche. I don't want to get too into all of this mystery, but a little bit of it shows us that we're going beyond our normal understanding. But he says he was had a visit from a Western scholar who's very, very interested in Tibetan Buddhism, John Driver, a key translator of Tibetan texts and so forth. I think he was at SOAS, School of Oriental and African Studies. He was visiting Bante in Kalimpong, and he wanted to meet some Tibetan scholar monks. So Bante introduced him to his teacher, Kachu Rinpoche. And Bante was having to translate, presumably a mixture of Nepali and bits of Tibetan, maybe some Hindi as well. And so John Driver would ask a question, Bante would translate, Kachu Rinpoche would speak in Tibetan, Bante would, or in Nepali maybe, then Bante would translate back into English. And he said the conversation went on in that way. And at a certain point, he realised that Kachu Rinpoche was answering before he'd translated. And that he was picking up directly the questions that were being asked. And he said it was quite sort of ordinary. It was only after a little while he realised it was happening. And there are many strange stories about Chetol Sangye Dorje. Now, I tell these stories not to get us all Tibeto-philiac, but just to illustrate the fact that reality only seems to be ordered along the dimensions of space and time. And that whilst that is very useful for ordinary purposes, for arranging retreats at Padmaloka and getting to talks on time, reality actually is much more multidimensional, much more multivalent. And when we enter the stream, these sort of states begin to open up. We experience, yes, a realm of magic, a realm of mystery, which is richly creative, in which we experience imagination, but imagination unbounded by the literalistic projection to which it's so often subject in religious life. You know, often what religion has wonderful imaginative understandings then imposes upon them a literalistic historical framework. You know, so that we think he really was the Son of God and was born of a virgin. He was on an imaginative level, if you like, or you could see it in that way. But when we impose upon it a literalistic historical interpretation, we lose what it really means. I've often mentioned reading a book that I found on Padmavajra's shelves, a biography of Ayatollah Khomeini. It worries you, doesn't it? When the whatever he is of Padmaloka is reading that sort of book. What was striking about Khomeini was that he had a very strong mystical streak. He was a mystic. But he interpreted his mystical experiences quite literally. So he felt he was in contact with the hidden imam and thought, therefore, that he was the emissary of the hidden imam, which led to the death of, I think they say, something like 1 million people in the Iraq-Iran wars. So when imagination is literalized, it's very dangerous. But when you enter the stream of the Dhamma, you just experience imagination as imagination. You don't impose upon it a literalistic interpretation. And nor, of course, dismiss it or bound it with a dismissive scepticism. You take it as it really is, without reading it in terms of space and time, as it were, too literalistically, nor too dismissively. You accept this flow of imaginative states in their own terms, on their own terms. And in this uninterrupted flow of creative, imaginative experience, these archetypal figures emerge. These archetypal figures are the expressions of that flow of creative energy that you enter when you enter the stream of the Dhamma. Now, of course, you can't practice this, if you see what I mean, when you haven't entered the stream, when you haven't broken free from ego clinging. You can't exactly practice it. You can't have this experience. You can maybe have intuitions of it. You can have moments of it. You can enter it from time to time. But you can't sort of set out to be in that stream directly. You have to create the conditions in order to do so. It is a spontaneous unfolding. You can't force it. You can only set up the conditions for it. It unfolds in dependence on preceding work on integration, positive emotion, developing the capacity to respond, and spiritual death. However, we need a connection with it. We need a connection with that unfolding experience. If we don't have that, we so easily fall back into nihilistic materialism. And all our spiritual life can be simply sort of humanistic meliorism, just making ourselves a little better as a human being, rather than going for what transcends humanity, if you like, in the sense of transcends self-clinging. Life bounded only by birth and death, so that all our so-called spiritual endeavour is simply about being a good human being. Better to be a good human being than a bad one, but, as I've said, the good is the enemy of the best. And the best goes beyond life and death. A life bounded by birth and death is, in Buddhist tradition, uccedavad. Ucceda means cutting off. That is a nihilism. A life that's cut off at death. So we don't see anything more in life than a brief efflorescence which happens when we're born and ends when we die. So, yes, if we don't have a connection with that magical, mysterious, creative dimension that unfolds after spiritual death, we fall back into a nihilistic materialism. We don't have any sense of a trans-egoic dimension. So we're thrust back upon I, and the, at best, improvement of I. We have no object for our faith. There's a very great danger for Buddhists. It's a very great danger for modern Buddhists in the West, because we're surrounded by a materialistic culture which has a horror in certain areas for the very destructive literalized idealism of the past. We've seen the danger of idealism. The 20th century is littered with bodies from that sort of idealism. The history of Christianity is a history of so much persecution, at least on one side. So we see the danger of this literalization of imagination, and we reject it. Especially since Voltaire, the French again, écraser l'infâme, destroy the infamous thing, this sort of false, distorted imagination of religion. We've reacted against that. Jolly good thing too. But in that rejection, we lose something. And we lose something which we Buddhists then come to Buddhism already lost. And we need to find a way of objectifying this transcendental dimension, this transcendental flow, which can be an object for our feeling. This is the issue that we have to deal with now. If there's no object for our faith, there's no faith. If there's no object for our responsiveness, we can't respond. We just fall back onto lower goals and aims. This is the great danger for modern Buddhists, because Buddhism is non-theistic. Hooray! But in that non-theism, we're in danger of just falling back into atheism. I think this is a vital a negotiation that we have to undertake. For those who are interested, Vide, Subhuti, Rambles, LBC, November 2012. The hell of atheism. That was the theme of the talks. The death of God and the hell of atheism. So this is really the problem for us. In accepting necessarily the death of God, we fall into the hell of atheism, which is shallow, narrow boundaries that are too close to us and don't allow the full flight of our human possibility, of our imaginations, of our erotic power, and that circles back on I. So we need a transcendental object. And this is, I think, it's Bhante's particular genius. What he's given us in the Triratna community is a very strong emphasis on discovering that transcendental object and bringing it more and more to life for us. So let me explain what I mean by this. You know, you might say, well, how can you have a transcendental object? Isn't transcendental by definition a transcendental object by definition a contradiction in terms, because surely the transcendental is transcending subject object. It's not that simple, I'm afraid, and I'm going to here give you a quite brilliant but quite complex exposition. That is, if you miss it, it's not my fault, it's yours. You're not brilliant enough to fly with me. So although the Dhamma and Dhamma Niyama processes are not fixed entities, they're not objects in the sense of fixed atma, atmans, they're not fixed realities, they're not metaphysical substances, nonetheless, we have to find them or make them into or relate to them as objects. This is the paradox. You know, Buddhism, if nothing else, is about the rigorous chasing out of our psyches of all fixity, the chasing out of our understanding of all internal fixed eyes or external fixed metaphysical realities. That's what, you know, Atmavada, the central theme of Buddhism, is. Shunyata is this absence anywhere of anything fixed. And yet, we need an object, a transcendental object. So what? I was going to say, what the hell is that? That's perhaps the best way of putting it. Well, we have to start with the nature of our experience. We went into this a bit yesterday, but let me recapitulate. Our experience is structured around an inward perceiving and an outward perceived aspect. That's the way it just naturally emerges because of the kind of organism that we are. We've got sense organs that deliver to us our experience with a polarity. It's not a sharp polarity, there's a sort of gradation between inner and outer. But it comes naturally like that. You can't have it any other way. your eye, as it were, sees something, and your sense of your consciousness, as it were, is inner, and the object is, as it were, outer. That's given. That's the way the sense organs are structured. That's the way the whole organism is structured. It can't be any other way. And it is true for Buddhas and for ants. Well, I can't speak for ants, but it's true for Buddhas, and it's true, presumably, for any organism that has sensory consciousness. It's got an inner perceiving and an outward perceived dimension. You've got sort of feelings and so forth that are more this side, and colour, shape, and so forth, it's more that side. The objective constituents of the perceptual situation and the subjective constituents of the perceptual situation, rupa and nama, if you see what I mean. It's built in, it's given. But what we saw yesterday is that we take the raw data of our experience and then we impose upon it a mental construction of a real subject, a unitary fixed subject that has an experience of a real fixed objective world to which all of the experiences we have belong. It, in a way, can't be any other way. Kant, Schopenhauer, etc. So we add on these putative subjects and objects. But as we saw yesterday, they're not merely ideas, they're not merely thoughts or concepts. They are strongly affective. We care about that idea of ourselves that we've read into our experience. And it's quite useful. It's what makes life possible in some ways. And we care about those elements of what we consider to be an external world that seem to make us safe and happy and comfortable and pleasant, and we reject and fear and hate those elements that seem to threaten us. So it's strongly affective. It's not just a thought. It's not enough just to realise, objectively speaking, philosophically speaking, that they don't have any reality. You have to get down to the really strong, passionate attachment. So we fix I and the world into real, mutually exclusive realities. And then there's a powerful connection between them, either a powerful connection of attraction or a powerful connection of repulsion, if you see what I mean, because repulsion is a sort of attraction or a sort of connection, because it's a connection of rejection. You know, the famous line in Casablanca, "You hate me, Johnny, don't you? You hate me." And he replies, "I would hate you probably if I thought enough about you." No, you despise me. Sorry, not hate you. But, you know, hatred is a caring. It's a connection. It's an erotic response, if you like. So, yes, you have a fixed eye, a fixed world, and a strong, a powerful, erotic, affective connection between them, which is attractive, repulsive, and so on. So, yes, but this is where we start from. This is where, brothers, we all are. We're sitting here in that situation. You've all got an eye, and I am part of the object to your eye, I regret to say. And you have your own responses to it. I rather hope that they're in the favourable variety, but probably not always or altogether, I'm sure. Inevitably, there will be attractions and repulsions. Fascinating watching it come and go. That's the situation we're in all the time. We're in the situation of an imputed self, metaphysical reality standing behind, which is not thought of as metaphysical, it's thought of as real, and an imputed external that is thought of as fixed and real. And then a very powerful current moving between them and within them. Sometimes we don't experience it as powerful because it's so diffused or so fixed, because we've created a sort of a carapace of self, as I put it. We've arranged the world so that it sort of matches our attractions. We don't notice them. You never notice how much dependent you are on your girlfriend or boyfriend until she or he drops you. Then you realize how dependent you are. You know that strange thing you notice with your friends, that he doesn't seem to really be that bothered about his girlfriend at all until she drops him, when he's a complete wreck. Because he's got his sort of attraction parked, so you don't notice it. That's what we're doing all the time. We're creating, we're rearranging the world so that it sort of matches and fits our attraction and repulsion. We're trying to move away from things that are awkward for us, and we're trying to build into our world what is attractive to us, what seems to confirm this sense of self. But this is where we are. We're all there. And it's important for us to just admit to the plain fact of it all. I remember Bhante, nothing if not provocative, having spent years and years and years debunking our Christian conditioning, he said to me quite recently that I've got quite some sympathy with the Christian doctrine of original sin. What original sin, please, Bhante? But what he means is this sort of tendency to polarise our experience and the powerful attractions that go with it. We brought with us. They're part of where we've come from. And they're where we've come from. They're what we brought with us. They're where we are. So we have to start with that. We have to start by taking possession of I. That's what you're doing with integration. You're taking responsibility for I. And karma is really to do with the nature of relationship between that imputed self and the imputed other. That's what karma is. It's the law of relationship between them. So you're working with that force, and you're trying to redirect the flow of your volitions within that. You're trying to modify the way in which you relate to the other so that the other supports your efforts, your karmic efforts. You're coming to Padmaloka, even though it isn't always convenient to you, always pleasant for you. You haven't always got the money for it. And anyway, you're rather upset by something somebody said to you on the last retreat or whatever. You come because you're deliberately trying to mould your external world so that it supports your karmic effort. So we're working within that framework, and we're trying to find within our experience something that can be an object for our powerful attractions that leads us outside that framework. Got it? So we're in that framework. We can't just take a sideways leap outside it. We have to find within the structure of that framework something that embodies what lies outside it. That is the transcendental object. And then we invest that transcendental object with the powerful attraction that the coinage of that dualistic framework, if you see what I mean. So we're trying to find this. This is what I mean by the erotic. We're trying to find this natural attraction and trying to connect it with something that points beyond it. If you can really get what this means, it's the key. You're working with what you've already got, what you've come with, what you're trying to get out of. You can't just leap out of it. You have to use the materials that you've got. And what you've got within those materials is something that reflects something beyond them. This is the mystery, the secret of the Dhamma life. You're using the power of ordinary attraction to draw you to what is beyond attraction. You're using I to mould your experience so that it goes beyond I. You're using the objects of attraction to take you beyond objects. So yes, this is the erotic power. Erotic power, as distinct from ordinary craving, is your connection with something within this framework that reflects what goes beyond that framework. Got it? So what I mean by the erotic is something that is experienced in the same raw way as ordinary craving is experienced, but it's directed to something that reflects outside that framework. This is the erotic. The sexual is simply wanting, well, you know what it is. Is wanting that release, wanting that pleasure, wanting that fulfillment, wanting that triumph, as it were, that gratification. And that's it. Done. Roll over and go to sleep, which is what irritates her so much. It's a sort of, it's so transparent in male sexuality in that way. But that's merely sexual. The erotic finds in the mundane object something that is a gleam, a glisten, a reflection of what goes beyond it. This is a very, very important principle, and it's found so strongly in a strand of the Western tradition that Bhante has really invoked quite often. It's in the Platonic tradition. If you want to refer more to this, just go and look at the Symposium. If you're not into boys, just forget that element of it. Forget any trace of homophobia or homo... what's the word for it? It's not phobia in the sense of an ideological position, but just a sort of slight disgust that many men have at that thought. Just forget that and just see what Socrates is getting at. What he's getting at is, in the famous Dream of Diotima, is the way in which you begin with a sexual attraction to a beautiful, well, in that case, boy, could be girl, and you're drawn from that attraction to an attraction to the qualities that they may have. And you're drawn from that attraction to the qualities that they may have to something that is deeper than those qualities or beyond those qualities, a potential within them, a potential that lies deep in reality. Now, you've got to be very careful with this as a method. I'm not recommending it. Well, we won't go there. But it illustrates a process, because, of course, sexual attraction is probably the most powerful attraction that most of us experience, the most powerful animal instinct that we have. Food is powerful, but it's more kind of a slow, sluggish often. But you will kill for hunger, but you'll much more readily kill for sex. Not you personally, but one. Oh, I don't know, maybe. So this illustrates what we mean by the erotic. It's where you've got a straightforward attraction. Art is probably a more refined version of the same thing, where you're powerfully attracted to, what might we say, a piece of music. And, you know, your first response to it is inarticulate. You can't say what it is. And in fact, if you can articulate it too quickly, it almost certainly means you're just having a titillating thought and you're very pleased with your clever ideas, which so much criticism is, isn't it? It's just clever ideas. Real criticism is revealing these natural erotic responses to the aesthetic object. So you respond, you don't almost know why. There's something catches you. And you can reflect a little bit. If you reflect too much, you kill the response, unless you've really developed that aesthetic faculty to a very high degree. But I mentioned it the other day, even I wasn't joking, in connection with something like football, that there can be in a sport like that something of art. Padma Vajra was mentioning, you know, the Brazilian team with Pele in when was the 1970. There we are, 1970s World Cup. Promoted as looking shocked. But, you know, you see something that's more than just you know, trying to win. There's an art to it, a delicacy, a play. It's not transcendental, but there's a gleam of something more, and you sense in yourself something, and you you want to go like, oh, wow, God, how so beautiful, or, God, you just can't articulate it. Not me, I'm afraid. I'm not into all of that nonsense. But you can see it in dance, for instance. I just watched some flamenco the other day. Very, very good piece of flamenco. If you want to watch it, it's on YouTube. La Vertige de la Trance by Tony... can't remember his name. Anyway, I'll remember it in a while. But the first performer he almost does nothing. He just stands for a while, although the way he stands itself makes you think, you wake up and feel there's something more here. Then there's just a few movements. It just takes, you know, half a minute and it's over. But you've seen something. You've seen something of grace and agility and sensitivity that is far more than what the raw movement contains. So the art of a Dhamma life is finding those things that glimmer with something beyond, even if it only at a very slightly elevated human level. Do you see what I mean? This is the whole point. We are inextricably bound up with duality. That's who we are. And duality is inextricably bound up with a connection between the poles. That connection is vital, powerful, unthought. Thought can shape, but in the end, it's just response, repulsion. And we're taking that repulsion, that attraction, and we're gradually allowing ourselves to pick those objects that glint of something higher. There's the essential method of spiritual life. Faith is where that powerful attraction finally hits something, an object, that really does embody what is transcendent, what transcends that very framework. Something that for us is powerfully attractive, but hints at, or more than hints, speaks of something further. Our response to a mundane object, person, idea, that carries a spark of something transcendental, a spark of the Dhamma, even of these Dhamma Niyama processes. That's why we're all here, I take it. I take it you're not so stupid that you come here without something of that. I do you the honour, sirs, of assuming that you have that. You know what I mean. I'm talking like this because I know that you know what I mean. There's something that's hinted at something more. Often you can't put it clearly. You get in woolly, vague, New Agey terms. Not you lot. New Age terms. You over-rationalise it. You get fixated on certain images. You get fixated on certain forms, which is, you know, when it becomes just a party, as it were, and in the political sense. But you felt that something, some configuration of mundane circumstances, a person, an object, an idea, an image, has hinted at something more. That is a glimpse of the transcendental object. The transcendental object is more than that, but it's found within it. So we need to find in our own lives the forms that carry the Dhamma for us, that carry the transcendental object for us, to which that erotic attraction, especially in its highest form of faith, can draw us. Faith is the transcendence of craving. It's craving directed towards something that hints at the transcendental. You know that in the Pali Canon, the Buddha speaks of karma, kama, chanda, longing, desire for sense experience, and dhamma, chanda, longing, desire for the Dhamma. And they're actually the same magnetic power, but that magnetic power is going to something that glints of the Dhamma. You could even speak of Kama Trishna and Dhamma Trishna. And here I strongly recommend a very good essay by Sagarmati called Three Cheers for Trishna, in which he sort of explores this powerful attraction. I can't remember the reference. If you want to find it, you look at my Revering and Relying on the Dhamma. In the footnotes, I make the reference. It's a very important, I think, sort of a drawing out that he does there. But it's this basic instinctual drive that gets transcended in faith. When I say transcended, I don't mean becomes all wishy-washy and limp-wristed, as it were, but that is powerfully directed to what is transcendent. That's what we're trying to find. We need something that carries the Dhamma. Football, I'm really sorry to say, won't do in the end. It's good for developing that spiritual receptivity, or just receptivity, aesthetic receptivity, you could say, at that level. But in the end, I doubt if... I'm trying to think of a footballer. I couldn't think of Shane Warne, but I think he's a cricketer. something like that. Wayne Rooney, that's it. I knew it was something Australian. Football just won't do. It's difficult. I'm sure if you're a disciple of Pramudita, you will be following the Arsenal path to perfect truth, to that great FA Cup in the sky. But it won't do. It can't carry it, as it were. The object needs to be capable of carrying the transcendental. And although in principle everything can, in reality, it can't. Of course, I'm sure that it's possible to gain enlightenment watching a really good free kick. I'm quite serious. I think that if you were sufficiently sort of poetically inspired by the game, a certain moment in it could trip you over. But I think you'd have to be... I've done a lot of other work. I've been to Padmaloka a hell of a lot and sat at Pramudita's feet. Well, maybe not sat at his feet, but watched his feet. I'm making a serious point amidst all this jocularity. In a sense, anything is capable of being a transcendental object. You know, you're famous in Zen, isn't it? The man who goes on a sesshin and then goes to a prostitute, and at the operative moment, bang, he's there. I mean, in enlightenment. we need an object that we can work with, that can we can direct our natural responsiveness to, but that is capable of containing this deeper meaning, this deeper transcendental meaning. And for Buddhists, it's primarily the Buddha who is that sort of focus for our craving, our Dhammachanda. Probably the most universal and effective symbol as a transcendental object. There's very strong historical connections. So it's very concrete for us. It's particularly apposite for us in the West, where our historical sense is so highly developed and increasingly all over the world. And of course, he did gain enlightenment, and the teaching that we get, the idea of enlightenment that we get, comes through him. But we need consciously to cultivate our connection with the Buddha as probably the best and most ready and effective transcendental object. We need to develop our sense of him as a historical person, reading about him, thinking about him, reading the suttas. We need to get a stronger and stronger image of him, whether it's literally a visual image or a sense of him. Pilgrimage is really important in that way. Go to the places where he was and you'll get a very powerful sense of him, particularly Bodh Gaya. Or I often talk about my experience with Maitreya, going to a park in South Delhi in the midst of a rather unprepossessing suburb. There's a little, very unkempt park, and in the middle of that park there's an outcrop of rock. And on the top of that outcrop of rock, completely untended, unadorned, unlauded, is an Ashokan period inscription saying this is where the Buddha preached the Satipatthana Sutta. I remember when we went there, it was 45 degrees, baking hot, the rock was burning hot. But I remember the sense, we went with a group of friends, I remember the sense of almost not being able to believe I was there. A sort of sense of connection across time. So that pilgrim is a very, very important practice for developing Dhammachanda, for developing this connection with what goes beyond. You're developing your image of him, your connection with him, developing in your environment things that do represent him and so on. Gaining a strong feeling for his qualities. Different people are going to find different modes of attraction. For some people it's going to be more, not abstract, but more a sort of feeling for peace, for the complete peace that he embodied, or the wonderful clarity, or the sense of fulfillment, or the strong sense of connection without any sense of discontinuity. whatever it is, unpack for yourself your image of the Buddha. And when I say image, I don't mean visual image. I don't even mean necessarily sensory image. Your sense of the Buddha. It can even be a kinetic sense. The Buddha is here. I think that for me is the most powerful thing, is that sitting in meditation and thinking of the Buddha, and I feel he's there. Don't necessarily have any idea of him. So this is what we need to be working at. We have to work with our own erotic responses, using that term again, because it evokes the power and the naturalness of that response, our faith, working with those natural responses and hooking them more and more powerfully to images of the Buddha, the transcendental image of the Buddha, the transcendental object imaged in the Buddha. It's a very sort of delicate, subtle, artistic, craftsman-like working with your own inner processes and your own inner attractions and the images that appeal to you. Really paying attention to them and trying to coax your feelings towards them, and being very honest about what's going on, not sentimental or assuming. Often, lack of attraction is a key to attraction. It's very, very important. Aversion, as I've already pointed out, is magnetic. If you see what I mean? Magnetic repulsion is magnetic, and it can be a key to the attraction. Of course, for some people, the images of the bodhisattvas, the archetypal Buddhas and bodhisattvas, which arise within the Dhamma Niyama processes, can be effective embodiments of the transcendental object. And so you work with them if they work for you. This is the work of spiritual rebirth, when you haven't yet been reborn. The work is bringing to life the transcendental object and hooking your dhammic responsiveness to it. Watching your own responses, taking the image of the Buddha in whatever way appeals to you, enriching it, dwelling upon it, getting lost in it, being carried away by it, transported by it, having an ecstatic transport in relation to it. It won't happen quickly. It's delicate work. It needs strict honesty, and it needs a great deal of self-investigation and a lot of, as I say, this very sensitive, craftsman-like, artist-like working with your own energies. Without a transcendental object that is psychically charged, the Dhamma becomes mere concepts, and practice becomes a mere humanistic moralism. It becomes Nietzsche's Western Buddhism. It becomes the perfect adjunct, as apparently somebody's been arguing recently, of an ordinary consumerist lifestyle. It just makes you a nicer consumer. It's good, but the good is the enemy of the best. Without that transcendental object, Buddhism is not Buddhism. It is merely humanism. And humanism, good as it is stifling to the human spirit. As an order member, you're committed to being spiritually reborn. That's what you're doing when you say Buddhang Saranang Gacchami, Dhammang Saranang Gacchami, Sanghang Saranang Gacchami. That's what you're going to be doing when you enter the ordination kuti, when you have your public ordination, when the kesa is placed around your neck. You are openly declaring yourself to be committed to dying and being reborn, and committing to working towards that transcendental object. And we will only ordain you when we feel that transcendental object is really alive for you, and that you are erotically, you know, to overwork that metaphor, connected to it. So under the heading of spiritual receptivity, we talk about cultivating that dhammic responsiveness. We've been cultivating a capacity to respond. But under the heading of spiritual rebirth, we practice working with that spiritual responsiveness to bring it into relationship with a transcendental object. Do you see what I mean? The spiritual receptivity is more to do with preparation of the faculty. Spiritual rebirth is to do with hooking that to the transcendental object. So we are looking to see whether you are doing this effectively. We won't ordain you, I hope, I'm sure we won't, until we know that you have an effective connection with the Buddha as the transcendental object, whatever the form that takes. And we will be, as it were, confirming that connection, confirming that this connection is the lodestar of your life, the compass that points you, the mystic orient towards which you're moving. And when we see that that is truly happening, then we will ordain you, I promise you.